Hello, everybody. I'm Kevin Witham. Welcome to Season 4 of the Common Grounds Unity Podcast. Jesus prayed for unity so that the world may believe. Our mission is to connect and gather with Christians outside one's family of churches because we believe unity starts by building relationships. We say unity starts with a cup of coffee. So grab a cup and let's get started with another conversation.
Hello and welcome to the Common Grounds Unity Podcast, episode 141, the second episode in our series on kingdom citizenship. Today we're going to be talking with Sean Palmer about his book, Unarmed Empire, In Search of Beloved Community. Well, Sean Palmer is the author of Speaking by the Numbers, Enneagram Wisdom for Teachers, Pastors, and Communicators, and also 40 Days on Being a Three, Enneagram Daily Reflections. He is also the teaching pastor for Ecclesia Houston, one of America's most innovative and vibrant multi-site churches serving a predominance of millennials and young adults. Sean and his wife, Rochelle, have been married for 24 years and live in Houston, Texas with their two teenage daughters. Welcome, Sean.
Hey, thanks for having me. I need to update my bio. We have now been married for 26 years.
26? Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and I don't know how you do the math on this. Like, we live with one of our daughters. The other one is in college, so she's here a good bit of the year. But we're trying to figure out our own negotiation of, does she live here? Does she not live here? How should she leave her room is the basic question that we're asking.
Yeah. And can you use her room?
Yes. And we've got one more who will leave the nest in about a year's time from when we're recording this. So, yeah, thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Absolutely. First, I want to hear a little bit about your decision to write this book. And it seems like, from what I understand, when you first tried to get this ball rolling on this book, you weren't getting a lot of bites on people wanting to publish about church. They wanted to, you say, sticky topics. They wanted to talk about other things, but weren't really interested in a book that is essentially about church. And so tell me why that burden was on your heart and why you think people weren't really wanting to hear about it.
Yeah, I think that's multifaceted. And what you need to know about that, Drew, is for me, I started in earnest writing this book about a decade ago. I grew up in a faith tradition that actually places a lot of emphasis on the local church and being the church in the world. Some of that was misguided in that we put way too much emphasis on church practice. And oftentimes church practice is what made you a Christian or kept you in good standing with God. And it could seem as if the only thing that mattered was showing up at the right place at the right time and doing the right things in the right order. But I started looking around the Christian landscape and noticing that a lot of the places where Christians were going sideways in culture was because of an inefficient or anemic understanding of who we were as the church. And churches started to become places for individuals to go to have their individual needs met. But there are these huge gaps in church practice that could be informative. And it's when people leave harmed, hurt, depressed because of an experience they had with Christians, they don't say, that guy, that girl, those Christians hurt me. They say, the church hurt me.
Yeah.
And they have good reason for saying it. And I was at a time where I was thinking about what kind of church do I envision my children would be interested in being a part of in their adulthood? When Rochelle and I weren't loading them in the car anymore and taking them on Sundays and Wednesdays, and you're going to go to youth group and you're going to go to camp and all of these things. And not just from a consumer perspective, but from a New Testament biblical perspective, like what should we do? And what were those early Christians trying to do in the world? That's not to uphold the early Christians or the early first century church as the perfect way to do it, but what were their aspirations?
Yeah.
And so I wanted to think through that and have Christians think through that. And the response I got is no one's interested in this. What people are interested in is the F's, which are great: faith, family, finances, future. for the individual and what was moving in the marketplace. Because whenever you're writing a book, regardless of what your ideas are about that book, what you're doing at some level is producing something that has market pressures on it. So a publisher, the editors, the graphics design people, folks who do the typesetting, guy who loads the boxes in the van to move it to wherever it has to go. Like, those people have families to feed. And so they are incentivized to publish, put their energies into the kind of work that's going to move the most units.
Right.
So if there's a if there's a belief that people aren't interested in a topic, then publishers are disinclined to publish it. That was the content that was being published. But that was exactly my point, because those ideas aren't getting out there, because people aren't being challenged with asking questions about what is it that we do together? What's God inviting us to do as a local church, as a community, as a universal church? Then it all becomes about the individual or the individual's family and getting some sort of therapeutic relief from being a faithful person, which says nothing about what the church is called to be and do in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things you latch on to earlier is early in your book is the idea of church needing to be a safe place. And I love the illustration you give talking about the killdeer finding places in your parking lot and y'all protecting them as they nested on the ground, and then the rabbits. And share a little bit about that story and what that led you to think about the church.
Well, it was so interesting. We had this broken up parking lot at the church where I was serving at the time. And in the back, where all of the leaders, worship leaders, people who are doing light and sound and all that, where we would park on Sunday morning because we were getting there early, saving those closer in spots for guests and members, that there's just this rubble of a parking lot. And it was broken up gravel, so it's black and white and gray. And every spring, killdeer would come and nest there, like right in the middle of the parking lot, because killdeer eggs are white eggs, but they're speckled with black dots and gray dots. And I don't know anything about birds. The only reason I know that they were killdeer is because I took a picture of them and asked people I know who know birds, namely, in this case, interestingly, Scott McKnight. And he was like, oh, this is what that bird is.
Yeah.
And one Sunday morning, I noticed we had this really gruff kind of sound engineer. He was a nice guy, but just his outward affect just gave off like not the kind of guy that you would mess with. And he's walking back from inside of our sanctuary with these large pylons, these orange cones. And he sets these cones around this broken up piece of concrete where these killdeer have laid their eggs. Now, killdeer are not particularly rare birds. It's not like there was a great find there. Like, they're extraordinarily common. But it was this picture for me like, oh, here is something that needs to be protected. And we are going to be a place where things that are vulnerable are protected.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be rare.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't have to be, you don't have to be rare or special. But because someone not even thinking about it could drive through that park, the back of the parking lot, not see it and run over these birds. So we put cones out because even in people's random, just going through their life, everyday sort of thing, you have the potential for harm. And if we saw potential harm, we wanted to be able to protect those who, we're going to be harmed. And so I don't think, I mean, you've probably read Unarmed Empire more recently than I have. I don't think I use the language of safe space only because that's more recent language in the popular culture than when I wrote the book. But definitely, I think it's important for churches to reclaim a space where the vulnerable are protected.
Yeah.
And like with that, we go out of our way to make sure this is a place where you will not be harmed. And we will try to do our best, even if the harm would be unintentional.
Yeah, that kind of haunts me, that image of the eggs, and you're talking about people driving through, not even knowing that there's these vulnerable lives there and harming them unintentionally. As somebody's been in ministry for a couple of decades, it's like, I wonder how many eggs I've driven over, not meaning to hurt people. But that doesn't just get blamed on me. Like you said, that gets blamed on the church. It wasn't just Drew being stupid or careless. It was the church has wounded me. And, you know, I don't know, right. You know, but it's one of those things like, man, a lot of woundedness comes into our communities, and too often we're not a safe place for vulnerable people. But you talk about two people who were wounded by church, or as he turned off at mm-hmm. church because they saw that it was not safe. You name them Nicole and Wes, and I understand those are pseudonyms, but Nicole said she didn't feel safe at church because she got the strong impression that Democrats like her were not welcome in a church. And then there's the guy, Wes, who noticed that somebody was using a lot of hateful language towards mm-hmm. people who are homosexual. And both these people were like, I'm never going to step back in church. Right. These are not isolated events. They're part of a larger problem. Could you speak a little bit about that larger problem? Of what it is about the current church culture that is so prone to wound in these ways.
Yeah, so there's so much about that. You know, interestingly, one of those is a pseudonym. The other one is not Wes, who's, you know, as of our recording, his birthday was yesterday. So we just talked yesterday. So here is the waters that Christians have to navigate. Is that our rhetoric, our holy book, our theology, our history says we are one thing. And we are very often not that one thing. And what happens for too many people is that they come into our doors looking at our communities and they're hopeful that we are that one thing that is promised, that community of grace and hope and love, a place to discover faith, that we are marked by the fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. And then they get there, and too many of us are not only not those things, but often the opposite of those things. That is not a people full of joy. It's a people full of contempt. It's not people who are gentle. It's people who are harsh and critical. It's not people who experience self-control. What they actually want is other control, like either through politics or through domination. Like one of the things that we're faced with right now is that there is a large segment of Christians in America who just want cultural control. They don't care if people experience Jesus, if they have a transformative inner encounter with the Holy Spirit. They don't care if people come to a loving knowledge of God. They just want to say, I believe this. And so the thing that I believe, I want you to have to abide by. So, and we sillily call that living by our convictions, but the church does not understand that you cannot have, by definition, you cannot have convictions for other people. You can only have convictions for yourself. So when people say like, how can I do this without sacrificing my convictions? Well, no one's ever asked you to sacrifice your convictions. Like, I'm just asking you to not make your convictions my convictions. And yeah. when you want people to behave a certain way or to believe certain things that they have not arrived at on their own, that is not faith. That is power. That is domination. And because we have called ourselves a Christian country, particularly in the West for so long, in America, that we cannot imagine that a church could thrive without cultural and political power. And so when we have a chance to choose between faith and power, we always choose power.
Yeah.
Because faith takes too long. It's too unwieldy. You have to trust people. And we don't want to do any of those things. I think you could turn on the news today, sitting here in 2024, and what you will see is a dominant Christian voice, though I don't know that it speaks for the majority of American Christians. But you will see a predominant Christian voice that says, we have just chosen raw power over faith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you say one of your quotes that really stood out to me is, this tangle Christians created erupted from one central misguided longing, the desire to possess an empire. Mm-hmm. That's really powerful, and I think speaks to so much of what we're seeing in our culture today. And this series in our podcast is trying to redirect our attention to the kingdom, and we're very distracted with partisan politics and trying to, you know, play king of the hill of a nation that is temporary, that will come to an end one day, and we're called to live into the kingdom of God. And it's tragic. You write something that's I thought was really brilliant. You said, until Jesus is killed, no one thought that racism, segregation, and classism were wrong. Mm-hmm. No one thought sexism or ethnocentrism were wrong. No one, but God did. And that's the central meaning of the, and that it's central to the meaning of the cross. I don't think a lot of people would see it that way. I don't think a lot of people would see that as a central thing, but to the cross, because I think we're hung up on, you know, trying to explain the atonement theories and stuff like that. But seeing this social justice and how everyone is valued as central to the cross, I think is powerful and true. And I'd love for you to just kind of unpack that a little bit.
Yeah. So, and so much work has been, good work has been done on this even since, like, I think about Tom Holland's book, Dominion, which I am about a quarter of the way through right now. But backstory for me is, before my dad became a high school principal and superintendent, he was a band director and American history teacher. And so I learned a lot of American history just at the footstep of my father, like sitting around the house, dinners, you know, just talking about history. And one of the principles he taught me about reading history is that if you will actually want to know what an event was about, then look what changed after the event. So the metric isn't what people before the event said, or even what people during the event said, but what happened after. So folks who will say, for instance, like the Civil War was about states' rights. Well, yes, but it was about a state's right to own slaves. And the reason that we know the Civil War was about slavery is because after the Civil War, that's what changed. That's the thing that changed. So now you take that back to the cross. So what happens at the cross is that the dividing wall of hostility is torn down, as Ephesians 2 calls it. The veil is torn. All people everywhere now have direct access to Jesus. And the rest of the New Testament is about how do Jews and Gentiles live together under the banner of Jesus Christ. The Jews have long been God's people. They don't like the Gentiles, and they don't want all of their dirty Gentile habits. The Gentiles have been excluded from religion by the Jews. It's in every letter of the Apostle Paul. It's the central theme going forward. If you just even look at the book of Acts, what's happening there in Acts 15, Acts 10 with Peter, that's what actually happens. Like, the outgrowth after the cross isn't that people sit around and talk about atonement theories, right? Like, it's that there is a new way of being in the world. There's an alternative community where women are valued in a way that they've never been valued before. Slaves are valued in a way that they've never been valued before. You look at letters like Philemon. You have folks from all walks of life. Scott McKnight's book, A Fellowship of Difference, is really good on this. That's the thing that actually changed. And so the reason that we know what the cross was about isn't because of atonement theories. Like, people will say, well, the cross is about forgiveness of sins. Okay, then you have to do something theologically with the fact that before the cross, Jesus was forgiving people of their sins. So it can't be that it's the primary mechanism for forgiveness of sins, because Jesus is already doing that. So that actually doesn't change after the cross. But what does change after the cross is how we know this is what this thing was about, just like the Revolutionary War in America was about the colonies' ability to govern themselves. Civil War in America was about slavery. On and on and on. It's the thing that changes that tells us what the event was about.
And so a lot of the things that the church gets blamed for these days, or in its failures, are only known to be failures because the church initially taught the culture that there's a better way to live. You know,
like
the things that you mentioned, that these weren't issues before Christ, before the crucifixion. It's only after that, before that new community of God broke forth in powerful ways that were bringing all people together, that people say, oh, that's how we should be. And these other ways that are, you know, abusive or whatever, these are wrong. And I think sometimes we don't get enough credit for the good stuff. We get a lot of blame for the bad stuff. And
So it's very much like bad parents, where they raise their children with a certain set of values, virtues, guidelines, even rules. And kids grow up and look what their parents actually do and say, like, you don't believe the very thing that you taught me. You're full of crap. And parents go, well, yes, I do believe it. And the kid is like, well, why do you do all of these other things? And so what's happened in the course of history is that folks have reduced Christianity to a set of beliefs, and it's a belief-based faith rather than a practice-based faith, so that they can do whatever they want to do, so we can do whatever we want to do and say that we believe something differently than what we practice. And what we've seen over the last 40 years is simply our friends, neighbors, co-workers just calling bullcrap on our practice. And we will say, well, they're not interested in faith. It's like, actually, they are very much interested in faith. And Christians do not envision, too few of us envision, that the reason that I might want to sin less is not to please God, but because my sin actually hurts someone that God loves.
Oh, wow.
For me, increasingly as of late, is the realization that all ethics are rooted in the indwelling of the Holy Spirit. Like, the reason you want to be an ethical person is because the Spirit of God actually is inside of you. And the Spirit of God is actually inside of other people. So the reason you don't abuse people, you don't cheat people, you don't rob people, you don't lie to people, is because that is you practicing an offense against God's self.
Yeah, I've had similar thoughts about, you know, the root of all sin, I think, is, or what makes sin sinful is objectifying. You're basically dehumanizing other people when you are greedy, when you're lustful. You're all these things that are sinful. It's a way of devaluing other people and making them less than. And it's as people who are created in the image of God, that's, we should always have that calling us to a higher standard of being able to see that image in others. On that line of reconciliation, talking about what changes after the cross, and you see this diverse community coming together of all these different nationalities, different languages, different religious practices, and they all come together and break bread together. It's a beautiful picture of what can happen and what should be happening in Christian communities. And you say something that you say it really strongly, and I like that, and I like to lean into when somebody says something strongly intentionally. Only the church can accomplish reconciliation, and I do mean only. That's a quote. Reconciliation is our purpose, not merely a side project. Tell me about that. Only the church.
Yeah. And so part of that is rooted in what we were just talking about before, like just theology of creation and fruit of the Spirit, because for reconciliation to be fully reconciliation, like other people can forgive, but for reconciliation to take part requires the activity of God. And so obviously, like if you read the book, like I'm using the word church in the broadest possible terms, like those who are part of the family of God, not necessarily like those who are like gathering with you on the weekend.
Right.
And so that's a Second Corinthians move for me, in that we are called to be ministers of reconciliation, that there is a bringing together, a weaving together of all of the things that God initially put together that have been torn apart. And you can only do that through the Spirit of God, through a move of God. Everything else leaves too much on the table in terms of personal power and ambition. There are too many motives there for things we call reconciliation. Reconciliation is greater than justice. Justice is often used in reconciliation, but reconciliation is the fullest piece of all of those things, of forgiveness, of justice, of harmony, of unity, that is to be reconciled. And reconciliation has multiple facets. So to be reconciled means to be reconciled to yourself, to have a peace about what God has done in you and through you. It also means to be reconciled to other people, without which we experience tension and conflict constantly. And it means to be reconciled to God.
Yeah.
And reconciling the world to God. So if you take any of those pieces out, you don't have reconciliation. I know lots of people who are political activists, and they're very concerned about justice. And that is an aspect of reconciliation.
Yeah.
But only the fullest biblical understanding of what it means to be reconciled, to be reconstituted, that can only happen through God. So that's why I make that statement. And at the time that I wrote the book, and I still believe this is true, there are lots of Christians who are so fed up with the church that they were just going to say, like, I'm going to go do my own work over here, start an NGO that feeds and clothes people, provides clean water, grows trees, whatever. And I think all of those are fabulous. I support a number of them. But eventually, what I knew from people who engaged in those works, and this was the same, this is where Martin Luther King was with the civil rights movement, that he understood without the animating Spirit of God, you're only going to get so far.
Yeah.
And as far as you get, I mean, if hungry people are eating, that's great. Like no one's gonna be mad about that. But it eventually runs out. Plus, justice work, charity work is so exhausting that you have to be fed from another stream to keep going over the long term.
Mm.
Drew Baker here with Common Grounds Unity. Based on our conviction that the unity of the body of Christ is a gift of the Holy Spirit, we are offering two opportunities for you to abide more deeply in Christ. Abide Spiritual Formation Groups and Abide Retreats. The formation groups are small cohorts that meet for 12 weeks on Zoom using materials developed by Mission Alive. Total cost for participants is $99. Our Abide Retreat will again be held in North Carolina October 2nd through 4th, where participants will engage in individual and communal spiritual formation practices. Cost for this event is $299. For more information and how to participate in these opportunities, go to commongroundsunity.org/abide-groups.
But yeah, as you're talking about reconciliation, it seems like there's almost like a lowercase r reconciliation, like say two, you know, people who have no faith, you know, explicit faith convictions or whatever. They were divorced and then they got back together. Maybe that's lowercase reconciliation, which is just a tiny piece of the shalom, the fullness of unity that God desires and prays for. Like in John 17, that's one of the things we focus on, is that they may all be one as I am in you and you are in me. May they all be brought to complete unity. And yeah, that can only be done through through Christ, through that relationship with the Trinity. You talk about victims of the discourse, and you talk about two people who are divisive. There's a person you call Laura who treated you as an enemy because you went to a rally, a political rally that she was not did not approve of, treated you as though you're less than. And then you talk about yourself as a little kindergartner Pharisee in a Baptist school, and that image just cracks me up. You sitting in the corner singing invitation songs, refusing to be tainted. But these are, you talk about it as victims of the discourse. Tell me a little bit about the discourse that contributes to both those mindsets as they continue to play out today.
Yeah, so every one of us has voices that we trust for lots of different reasons. I mean, for me, it was the voice of my church as a kid. Like, it should, I mean, like the story you're talking about, Drew, in the book, I'm 5 years old in that story. And it's one of my earliest memories. But this is what my parents said. This is what my grandparents said. Everyone who loved me, or I felt like loved me, was telling me the same thing. Like, you know, those dirty Baptists or people in, you know, in my tribe, what the way we described it was like the denominations, were telling me like these people were not the people of God. And for Laura, what had happened with her is that that had been her politics. She had been a stay-at-home mom her entire life. She was in her 60s when I had met her. Her TV, like she woke up in the morning and she tuned her TV to Fox News, and it was on there all the time. Her husband would get up in church to do announcements, and he would read some like little email. You know, back in those days, people had their political email. That was before Facebook, really. You know, and so people would share that kind of stuff. And everyone that she thought she could trust was telling her the same thing about people who didn't share all of her political opinions and viewpoints. And I was five, so it was much easier to uproot than someone who was 60.
Yeah.
Who, for both people who had been hearing their entire lives who the enemy was. And we're victims of the discourse in that neither one of us made that up ourselves.
Yeah.
There were people who had a vested interest, even if they thought it was in our own best interest, to have us believe the world was ordered in a certain way. And that has become commonplace. I remember, it's not the same, you know, and it goes back to the story of Nicole earlier in the book, because that was the exact same church. And so when you get up every Sunday and one of the leaders of the church, regardless of what else we're talking about, is giving right-wing talking points strongly, how else could you feel? Like, besides, people who don't agree with you are not welcomed here. And it's not that either no one has a good argument to make. It's that we're not even willing to have discussions about it. And you can't be around those kinds of voices for that long without it encroaching on your own thinking. So every kid who grows up in youth group, at least when I grew up in youth group, heard about stuff like garbage in, garbage out, right? And it was about music and movies and culture and all of that. But we never applied that to our news and media and political filter, that we were being just as formed by those outlets, even though some of them had the audacity to paint over their perspectives with God language. And no one's immune to it. You just, unless you live in a cave someplace and you don't ever listen to anyone about anything, and there are no free thinkers in the universe. Like, that's a myth. All of our thinking is informed by something, somewhere, someone over time.
Yeah. So in talking about, strongly committed Democrats, strongly committed Republicans, wouldn't it just be easier for them to worship at separate churches, or, you talk about what's called the homogeneous unit principle, and saying, organizations grow better if they don't have those other obstacles to overcome. If they can just unite on one thing and not have these other divisive things, it'd do better. Speak a little bit about that idea and why the kingdom is different.
Yeah, so the homogeneous unit principle is actually a missionary principle that had good reason for sprouting up when you are planting churches around the world. And so you go into a village or a city or town, and you have people with their own tribe, their tribes have a different leader, they have a different structure. It makes more sense to say, okay, if we're going to be about sharing the message of Jesus, we need to do that before we can get into the blood and guts of, hey, you're two tribes who may have been at war with each other at some point. Before we try to merge those horizons, let's do this other thing. That's essentially where it arose. But American church planters took that to say and said, what we need to do is we need to build around commonality and depress difference. And so you have somebody say, we're going to start a church in this zip code. We're going to go knock on doors. We're going to ask people, do they go to church? And if they don't go to church, what kind of church would they go to? And so then you launch that new church around those commonalities. So you pull up on Sunday morning and it's all blonde mom in a minivan with 2.3 kids and all of that. So you're not having to deal with difference. Now, that's a great way to grow a church. It's a terrible way to be a disciple, because as we talked about earlier, this is what discipleship is. It is bringing together all in the world that has been rent by sin and division and hate. Mm-hmm. And so if you are never actually invited, if you never have to do what the New Testament is doing, you can never actually be a New Testament Christian. And so then you build walls around, this is our church for our people. That church down the street needs to be their church for their people. And we'll wrap it up in language like cultural difference or issues like hymnody as a facade to say, what we really don't want is people who are different from us here, because that makes us uncomfortable. Then you'll have some churches say, well, we want to get more diverse. And they do up till about 15%. And when it becomes more than 15%, that's when organizations, not just churches, that's when all organizations go, hey, we were really proud of ourselves at 10%. At 15%, it gets awkward. And at 20%, that's when we start to hear the language of, those people or they are starting to take over. So I find that just interesting sociologically, that even places that say they want diversity have a sense of when they feel like that diversity is too much. And it's not at like 40, 50, 60%. It's well under that threshold.
Shed light on a verse that I really appreciate, because I've been reading it differently my entire life. John 10, I'm sending you out to be sheep among wolves. This is Jesus sending out his disciples, and he says, I'm sending you out to be sheep among wolves. And I always read that as kind of apologetic, like, oh man, I wish things were different, but for now, until we get the upper hand in the systems of power, you're going to be the underdogs here, and good luck with that. But you point out that this is a strategic theological choice that Jesus is making. This is how we're supposed to be. This is prescribed vulnerability. That just kind of blew me away. So I'd love to hear you talk a little bit more about why the vulnerability? Why is that central to Christ's call?
Yeah, and so that's kind of the play on the title of the book, because I've been asked about that. Like, when you title a book Unarmed Empire, you will hear how many people would think that it's impossible to have a kingdom or an empire that is inherently vulnerable or unarmed. Yeah. And I want to say that's the point, that God is inviting us into a kingdom that is a vulnerable kingdom, to where you can be taken advantage of. I mean, what we see, at least my read of our current moment in America, and why we struggle with the very things that you just mentioned, Drew, is that we are so comfortable, we are so empowered, and everything does feel like a threat, that over time we have imagined that the United States, which I love, but we have imagined that the United States is the kingdom of God. And we actually can't imagine things being any better. This is why when you ask people when the country was at its best, when it was like at Apex Mountain, they struggle to tell you, but they just sense that it was.
Yeah.
Right? We just, and whatever it was, we don't want to lose it. And everyone, one of us gets that. Every one of us has a goal or a telos in some area of our lives that we've reached, and we want to hang on to it, whether it's a relationship or maybe our kids or maybe a professional goal or a financial goal. And when you have a lot to hold on to, there are lots of threats, because whether real or imagined, you intuit that people are coming for your position, your power. So you get like Charlottesville, right? Mm-hmm. I guess this has been maybe close to 8 years ago, however, yeah, walking, young men walking through Charlottesville chanting, "They will not replace us."
Yeah.
Well, we don't, they don't really name who they are, and they don't name who us is or what they're trying to replace. But listen to the rhetoric of, "They will not replace us." Like, this is ours. This is mine. And then you ask them, okay, what is it that you're actually fearful of? How did you build this thing that is America? And you can't tell that story without telling the story of Native Americans. You can't tell that story about the $8 billion a year that slavery built in terms of the economy. What exactly did you do that you built? So you can't actually tell that story and say they will not replace us, because they have been here building the wealth of the nation the whole time. But it is this feeling that it's this entitlement that whatever it is ours. And that's when you know that you did not build something, you are even more vulnerable to the threat of it being taken away. It's like a church that grows or a business that grows, and they don't know why they grew so fast, right? It just kind of like happened overnight. So if it all goes away, they don't know how to replicate it. They don't know how to do it again. Or they know that the levers and tools they used to build it the first time are no longer available to them to do what they've done again. So you have to hoard, have to protect. I know several successful businessmen, and I can tell you, if they lost everything tomorrow, in 2 years, they would roughly be back in the same spot they are today, because they know how they built it, and they can replicate it. So they actually live with much less fear about the future, even though they might not want to have to do all of that again. Yeah. They know what to do it. So I think it's so incredibly multifaceted. There's not one single reason that we have responded in the last decade and a half the way we have. Some, I think, fear what some sociologists are suggesting, that we are in late stage capitalism and other issues like that. And they just don't know what to do with what's next. I do know this, that whenever any person or system or community experiences a shock, whether it's the death of a loved one, a financial setback, whatever it is, our biggest and first instinct is to get things back to the way they used to be as soon as possible. And I think in the last 30 years, the United States has experienced a huge cultural swing. And there are powers at work in our community that want things to go back to the way it was, even though they can't articulate what was so great about the way that it was.
Yeah, like you talk about this fear and the paradox of safety in the fear, as you know, you share an instance with your daughter in the pool, and you know, she's learning to swim, and she panics for a while and says, "You saved me," but you're like, "Yeah, I had you the whole time." And that's the thing I want Christians to know, is like, God's got us the whole time. Like, regardless of what goes down in culture, God's got us. And what do we have to be afraid of? You know, Romans 8, was it verse 38? That's just one of my favorite sections. Anyway, I'm going to skip on down a little bit. In chapter 11, you say something that I think is pretty powerful. You talk about how saying love one another has become so, I don't know what word you use, bland or so generic, to be almost useless as far as a fruit of the spirit, or you know, something that can be acted upon. But you talk about kindness and our call to be kindness, and it as a spiritual discipline. What does that look like? How can churches be places of kindness?
Yeah, one of the simplest places to begin that conversation is asking what is the kind thing to do in this moment, in this situation. We ask other questions. We ask questions about church growth. We ask about doctrine. We ask about practice. I've not been in very many meetings when we're discussing how to move forward in a particular area, when we say to one another, what would be the kind thing to do?
Yeah.
And to see kindness, I mean, this, and the you know, the big word chesed that the Old Testament uses for loving kindness, is this grand descriptor of who God is. To say, like, I can sacrifice the finer points of a doctrine to be kind, or I can shut up for a while if that's to be kind. We associate being kind with being nice. We associate being nice with being weak. There are a bunch of songs about standing up for the faith. There aren't a bunch of songs about being kind for the faith. And nevertheless, it's all throughout scripture. I think in the book, I use a story, you know, Job's friends, who no one there in Job's conversation has a theological answer for what's happened to Job. And from what they know in real time, Job's friends are more accurate than Job is. Like, they are giving an accurate understanding of God. And Job gets up at the end after they've had several days of telling him how he's gone wrong, and says to them, "You may be right. I'm not sure, but you have not been kind."
Yeah.
And like, I think that should be a full stop moment for Christians in our culture, whether it's just posting on Facebook or the way we go about the preaching and teaching task, to how we treat our neighbors, to how we treat people at work, to simply say in interactions, I'm going to choose to be kind, knowing that kindness comes with a certain level of vulnerability, and opening myself up to pain, heartache, and hurt, which I might not want.
You mentioned two movies in here, The Jerk and Lars and the Real Girl. Yeah. And I'll just say, those are two of my mom's favorite movies, very different movies. But Lars and the Real Girl, I'm not sure if we can concisely talk about what it, what it's about. But basically, there is The Gospel According to Lars and the Real Girl. This is a movie, powerful movie. Do you think you can succinctly tell you what is so inspiring about that movie and what it calls us to be as Christian communities?
Sure. I love that movie. It is, in my view, the most Christian movie that's been made in the last 25 years. Yeah. So Lars, played by Ryan Gosling, has a dissociative disorder. And in his loneliness and isolation, he orders what is intended to be a, for lack, I mean, there's no other way to put it, a sex doll off the from the internet. Mm-hmm. And I want people to know before they lose themselves in that, like,
he is chased.
The relation is a chaste relationship all the way through. But he introduces Bianca, what he names her, to his brother and sister-in-law who live in the house. He lives out in the garage. And obviously, everyone thinks that he has lost his mind because he thinks that he has a girlfriend in Bianca. Bianca is a returning missionary. She's in a wheelchair because she got sick. So he's created this whole world that explains, you know, why she doesn't move and all of this. Lars's brother, Gus, takes him to the town doctor. It's a small town, so this doctor just does everything. And they're very worried about him, as you would be. She checks out Bianca, listens to her heart, does the whole thing. It's so beautiful. And Gus and the doctor have a conversation after Lars and Bianca excuse themselves. And Gus is like, what are we going to do? And the doctor tells him, like, you're just going to go with it, right? You're just going to, which I have a story about that, too. She says, you're just going to go with it. And Gus says to her, people are going to think that he's crazy. And she says, and you, too. Mm-hmm. Like, they're going to think that you're crazy. But her whole thing is that she, that, hey, that there's going to come a time where he's not going to need Bianca anymore. Which reminds me of when our youngest daughter was very little and she kept sneaking into our room to sleep with us in bed. And I talked to a pediatrician about it. And I said, well, how long can we, like, what should we do to get this child out of our bed, right? And our pediatrician said, she will stop when she doesn't need it anymore. Mm-hmm. And she did.
Yeah.
And then what happens is, like, because Gus and his wife, Karen, embrace Bianca, the entire town does. And what's amazing about that is they are part of a local church. And so there's a little town council meeting about it. And they decide that they're just going to do what's best for Lars. So in the movie, there are three scenes that happen in church. And it's all during, each one happens during the sermon, during the teaching time. And every time in the movie, the text that's being preached about is about love. And so everyone needs to see this movie. It is just, it's a masterpiece. And it's about how, ultimately, how a fake girl teaches Lars how to be a real boy. Mm-hmm. And so I don't want to spoil how it ends for anyone who hasn't yet seen it. It is I don't cry very often. If you don't cry watching Lars and the Real Girl, you are dead inside.
Yeah.
And that is from someone like myself who considers myself dead inside. Yeah. there's these great interviews that Gosling did and the writer director did after the movie came out, and basically said, like, what would the world look like if we took everyone's struggles seriously and just opted to be as kind and as loving toward their healing as possible. It's absolutely beautiful story. Most of every book, 80% of the content is in the first 20% of the book. And so with Unarmed Empire, I wanted there to be good content all the way through. So I put Lars and the Real Girl, which I absolutely love and adore. And now that you've mentioned it and brought it back up, I'm going to have to watch over the weekend again.
I think I will too.
Yeah. It's absolutely stunning. And like I said, the most Christian movie in the last 20 years, mm-hmm. hands down to me. I'd watch that over The Chosen 1,000 times.
Oh, wow. that is hyper.
Not there's anything wrong with The Chosen.
Palmer, that's like The Chosen.
The Chosen's fine. It's just
I'm an Enneagram one, and so Lars and the Real Girl, it hurts me because I'm like, but it's not a real girl. It's like, you know,
right.
Let's be real. There's right, there's wrong. That I'm not going to be lying, mm-hmm. you know. And that's unfortunately how I've approached a lot of situations. That just the wrong way to approach a situation and people. And you show, or this movie shows that you draw out, is that people change through love and acceptance and feeling safe and secure. That's how change happens. It's not by, you know, an Enneagram one standing off like, you're doing it wrong. You know, that's not, you gotta change and live up to my expectations of you and my convictions for you.
There's this, you'll remember this, Drew. There's this just incredible scene toward the beginning of the third act where Bianca has become so busy in town, right? Like, she gets elected to the school board. Like, she's going out at night, like, with people are coming to pick her up. And Lars gets very mad because he doesn't ever get to see Bianca anymore. So he's out chopping wood out behind the house. And Karen, his sister-in-law, who is pregnant, comes out. And he's just complaining about Bianca. And Karen, who is a small woman who's pregnant, and she goes like, she's like basically calls him on it. She's like, we take her to her appointments. We take her to work. We clean her. We do this. And she says, she looks at Lars like screaming in the backyard. So I'm going to cry. And she goes, and we do it for you. Like, it's all for you. Which I think is what everybody like wants, right? Like, to be loved at that level, that like at your strangest, weirdest, worst, that there are these people who are willing to go out on a limb so far for you that the wood is cracking, mm-hmm. you know? So just one of the great movies. So I am on Letterboxd. If anyone wants to follow me on Letterboxd, which is a movie reviewing site, and, You get to name your top four movies on that site, and Lars and the Real Girl is eternally in my top four.
That's awesome. Oh, man. Well, we've taken up a good bit of your time. Need to bring this to a close. Thank you so much for your work on this book, Unarmed Empire. It was a wonderful read, wonderful conversation, and I hope more will pick it up and read it. Of course, you can get everything on Amazon. Any other place where folks can find this book?
Amazon is great. If you don't like that, you can always try Wiffenstock, WIPFSTOCK, Wiffenstock.com. Or if you're in the Houston area, we have supply at Ecclesia Houston, our downtown campus at 1100 Elder. That's actually the place you will find it the cheapest in our coffee shop there. So if you're in and around the Houston area and you want to pick up a copy, they have all three of my published trade books there. So that's the best place to get them.
Awesome. We at Common Grounds Unity have a vision to create and support gatherings of unity-minded Christians around the globe. Imagine the good news of these gatherings modeling the prayer of Jesus in our divided world. Thanks so much, Sean, and have a wonderful day.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Common Grounds Unity podcast. Please check out commongroundsunity.org to learn about who we are and to find gatherings in your area. You can also subscribe to our monthly digital newsletter, join the Facebook group, or find our YouTube channel. If you benefit from this ministry, please consider a monthly donation by going to www.commongroundsunity.org/donate. Until next time, God bless, and remember, unity starts with a cup of coffee.